Welcome everybody to our November Pulmonary Journal Club. We're going to be presenting four articles today, and the first two are going to be presented by our pulmonary pathology fellow here at Mayo, Dr. Lacey Schrader, who came to us after doing her residency at Loma Linda. So take it away, Lacey.
Okay. Good morning, everybody. And I hope you had a great Thanksgiving and everybody's staying healthy. So this first article comes from a group out of Italy and France. They looked at lung carcinoid tumors with high proliferative activity and suggested there's further support for the identification of a new tumor category in the classification of lung neuroendocrine neoplasms. As we know currently, the WHO 2015 classification of lung neuroendocrine tumors identifies four distinct categories: the typical carcinoid, the atypical carcinoid, large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma, and small cell lung carcinoma, based on architectural and cytological features, mitosis over a 2 millimeter square surface, and tumor necrosis. However, it does not take into account the use of Ki-67 index for tumor grading, supposedly because there's a conflicting literature out there when the 2015 classification was published. And as we know and often mentioned, the category of neuroendocrine tumor, grade 3, the NET G3, was first introduced in 2017, WHO pancreatic classification of neuroendocrine neoplasms. It's base currently defined as mitotic count greater than 10 per 2 millimeter square and a Ki-67 index of 20%. These G3 category shows a more aggressive behavior than the G1, G2 NETs and a lower response rate to the cisplatinum carboplatin-based chemotherapy that remains a therapeutic signature of our neuroendocrine carcinomas. And so this particular article suggests that or investigates if there are cases of the lung NET with carcinoid morphology that corresponds to the NET G3 category described in other tissue sites, and then evaluates them for clinical behavior, pathological features, and response to therapy. And so it's a retrospective review of a total of 630 cases of well-differentiated lung neuroendocrine tumors at two different sites. Cases were excluded if there was a diagnosis of poorly differentiated lung neuroendocrine carcinoma, unavailability of tissue for microscopic review, or there was no available clinical follow-up data, which in the end left 514 patients with well-differentiated lung neuroendocrine. And then based on they wanted to see how many of these tumors were considered a high proliferative lung neuroendocrine carcinoma or carcinoid tumor, and they based it on the Ki-67 index of greater than 20% and mitotic index greater than 10 per 2 millimeter squared, and in the end it left 30 patients. And of note, the Ki-67 was only available in 302 out of the 514, and among the tumors with the available Ki-67 index, 10%, which is 30 out of 302, were classified as the high proliferative lung carcinoid tumors. And then within the 30, 18 were localized or locally advanced lung neuroendocrine tumors, and 12 were metastatic disease. And then, sorry, I have to scroll down. When we look at the clinical pathological characteristics of these tumors, this 493, I'm not exactly sure where they got that. I think they meant this number right here, 484. When they looked at the 484 tumors that were classified with Ki-67 index below or equal to 20% versus the patients with Ki-67s greater than 20%, we find that most of them majority were female in both areas. And then when they looked at the primary histology of our high proliferative lung carcinoid tumors, 25, I don't know where the other five patient went, but three of them were categorized originally as typical carcinoid tumors, which suggests that despite having a low mitotic count, the Ki-67 was enough to put it into the high proliferative lung carcinoid group. And then 22 of the tumors were originally diagnosed as atypical carcinoid. And then as expected, more of these tumors were diagnosed at a higher grade versus the tumors that were less than, had a Ki-67 less than 20% or equal to.
Lacey, there was a big gap
in the numbers for the left side of the column between the typical atypical carcinoids and the total number. Were those considered neuroendocrine carcinomas? Is that where they disappeared to? Like, I don't get it.
Yeah, I don't get it either. And I assumed maybe, but they said that they screened out all those,
okay,
those patients.
So those are screened out.
And then they also said that they did not qualify the patient or the case if there was no basically no information on the case. So I'm a little bit confused where some of those patients went, but I noticed like sometimes there's numbers that don't add up, like this 493, I think was 484. So maybe that they messed up on their numbers.
And then they had histology on 352. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, sorry.
So is there any upper limit for Ki-67? Did they...
That was not defined.
Oh.
In this study.
Okay.
But they do in the end give what their highest Ki-67 was for their tumors that were categorized as the high proliferative lung carcinoid tumors. And we'll get to that in a second. And then when we look at reoccurrence-free survival in patients who underwent primary surgery, and we stratify them by the Ki-67 index, with the purple representing less than or equal to 5%, and the blue 6 to 20%, and then our yellow being our greater than 20%, we notice that their time to reoccurrence is shorter than the tumors that have a lower Ki-67 index. And then when we look at the median overall survival, median overall survival in metastatic patients from the diagnosis of metastatic disease and stratifying by the Ki-67, again, we see that the overall survival is worse for the patients that have a higher Ki-67, which, you know, we would expect. The interesting thing that I found from this article is, even though it's, you know, low end numbers, that the response to these particular tumors, these high proliferative lung carcinoid tumors, to the different types of therapy and the platinum-based chemotherapy, 5 out of 9 showed stable disease with a 5.1 median progression-free survival. And then everolimus had 8 patients, and 100% of those patients had stable disease with 12.1 median progression-free survival, and that's in months. And then this, I haven't heard of it until now, this peptide receptor radionucleotide therapy, 3 out of 5 showed stable disease with 14.2 months of median progression-free survival. And this becomes interesting because the lung neuroendocrine carcinomas are usually the standard of treatment is platinum-based chemotherapy. And these tumors seem, despite having overall survival when they're that is poor when they're metastatic, or time for reoccurrence, versus our tumors with a lower Ki-67, they seem to respond better to treatment that they originally used for carcinoid tumors, the everolimus. And this PRRT, I find interesting, and they, I hope they look more into that. So in the study, the highest Ki-67 index for a tumor that was classified as the high proliferative lung carcinoid tumor. 65% was the highest, and that's similar to another study that showed 62%, and then other studies showed 37, 43, and 56. And so they suggest that despite having well-differentiated appearance, these they still may have a high Ki-67 index. And then so overall, as they point out, there's several limitations to this study. It's a retrospective study. It seems like they have no structured centralized pathology review. And they also put into their study the metastatic carcinoid tumors, which the WHO 2015 classification really wasn't based on. And as noted before, some of their numbers don't seem to add up, and patients kind of disappear here and there in their calculations.
What classification do they, I probably missed something, but what categories do they propose?
So I think they didn't really give a standardization of what they propose, but it seems like they're getting at that maybe we should go along with like the pancreatic tumors and have like the categories that would include probably G1, G2, and a G3. I don't know, maybe somebody else got something out of reading it.
This seems to be a hot topic. Actually, I reviewed one article last month by Sozanova, and they just basically want to fine tune the current classification and expand the mitotic rate for atypical carcinoid from 2 to 20 instead of 2 to 10. And I know Natasha Reckman had a previous article with similar suggestions. And then, of course, Alberto Marchewski had a paper of 1 or 2 years ago, and basically he was proposing a new category within typical carcinoid with more than 5% Ki-67 proliferation index. So I think this is a hot topic, and probably something is going to happen here.
Do you think it's probably going to incorporate the Ki-67?
I think so. I mean, that would make sense.
Lacey, thank you. This is Tazelar. How many nuclei did they count? So, you know, in the pancreatic literature, it's often done digitally because they're looking at, 2,000 nuclei. What did they do here?
It's up here. So, I saw it earlier because they basically counted for actually
they
that
said
was more
they used
the Ki-6.
Oh, yeah, it looks like they use the same rules that the WHO proposes for GI tumors. I think the top of page, upper right on page, what is the page number here? Apparently, 151.
I'm just curious. Yeah. I assume everybody does digital counting these days for neuroendocrine tumors at other sites.
I don't.
Interesting.
Others, I'm just curious, can we take a poll?
We do for the pancreas, but we don't for the lung.
We are just validating the lung in Rochester. The validation study is almost complete, but we right now, the lung is still done manually, and the GI net is all done with digital imaging, but hopefully we'll be able to order the lung if indicated soon.
Is a hotspot versus just the whatever random resolved yet. And that's another area what we need to decide on. Like, has the in the Mayo validation, how will it be done?
Hotspot.
Hotspot, okay.
Yep.
Your study was average, right?
No. No? We did hotspot. We looked at both, and we decided that hotspot was more reproducible between the biopsy and the resection.
Okay. Jennifer's study can never be an average.
All right. Good discussion, everyone. So for the sake of time, Lacey, why don't you go ahead and move on to your next article?
A little bit bigger. And you guys don't see the faces off to the side, right? Blocking part of the article. Okay.
No, we just see
your article. I didn't think so, but wanted to make sure. For some reason, I can't make it smaller. Okay, so this next article is basically covering the results from the DORA trial, which looks at osimertinib and resected EGFR mutated non-small cell lung cancer. These results were presented at the ASCO 2020 virtual meeting as a plenary session. And from my understanding, it had a significant amount of discussion because of its potential for clinical impact, because currently completed resected stage 2 and 3A disease of and some stage 1B disease of non-small cell lung cancer, the gold standard treatment is postoperative adjuvant cisplatin-based chemotherapy with a 5% decrease in the risk of death over a five-year period. So there's significant room that we can improve there. And one of the realms that people are looking at based on the efficacy of EGFR TKIs in advanced diseases, if they can play into the part of these resected lower stage cases. And studies have shown that disease-free survival may be longer among patients with resected EGFR mutation positive non-small cell lung cancer who receive adjuvant first generation EGFR TKIs than among those who receive adjuvant chemotherapy or placebo. And I point out that this is disease-free survival, not overall survival. And because of the phase 3 FLORA trial, we know that osimertinib, which is a third generation EGFR TKI, it was superior to gefitinib or erlotinib with respect to progression-free and overall survival. So the ADORA trial was developed, which is a phase 3 double-blinded randomized trial that assessed the efficacy and safety of osimertinib as compared with placebo in patients with completed resected stage 1B to 3A non-squamous cell non-small cell lung cancer that have positive confirmed EGFR mutations in either exon 19 deletion or the L858R mutation. And then these patients could have administration of standard postoperative adjuvant chemotherapy before randomization based on the preference of the oncologist and the patient. This was an international trial randomized in a 1-to-1 ratio, and patients received osimertinib or placebo for 3 years or until disease recurrence or fulfillment of criteria for discontinuation. And the 3-year category was determined based on the previous EGFR trials. Where it said, yes, it was based on the 3-year duration of therapy was selected based on published adjuvant data from first generation EGFR TKIs, which showed early relapse after 2 years of therapy. And then importantly to point out, this trial was sponsored by AstraZeneca, the creators of osimertinib, and they also were responsible for collection and analysis of the data and had a role in the data interpretation. The primary endpoint was disease-free survival, according to investigators' assessment among patients with stage 2 and 3A disease. And the secondary endpoint included disease-free survival in overall population of patients with stage 1B, 2, 3A disease and overall survival, health-related quality of life, and safety. And the interesting thing is that based on this independent data monitoring committee and seeing significant efficacy of the osimertinib group, the trial was unblinded at a trial level early to complete primary reporting. The trial included 682 patients who underwent randomization. The baseline characteristics were balanced between the two groups, as you can see in this table. For example, this is the osimertinib group and this is the placebo group. We can see they were balanced between stage and also even the mutational status. Among the 470 patients with stage 2 to 3A, the percentage of patients who were alive and disease-free at 24 months was 90% in the osimertinib group and 44% in the placebo group. So we can look at the graph right here. This is the stage 2 to 3A disease, and the lower graph is when they incorporate for the stage 1B. And so there is, when you look at the osimertinib group, there's kind of like an early separation between that and the placebo and the probability of disease-free survival. At medium disease-free survival, the osimertinib group had not reached, but the placebo, there was 19.6 months. The hazard ratio for the disease recurrence or death was 0.17, giving a 83% reduction in risk of recurrence or death. And you could see there's kind of similar data points when they incorporate the 1B, but the hazard ratio for recurrence was 0.2. And then we can see that the osimertinib group was favored over placebo in almost in all of the other subcategories. Interesting to point out is that the higher the stage, the more benefit they got from the osimertinib, and also the exon 19 deletion had more benefit from the osimertinib than the L858R mutation. Additionally, osimertinib had some disease-free survival compared to placebo in terms of CNS disease. And the biggest thing to point out is that the previous studies using the EGFR TKIs with the first generation, that although they showed disease-free survival, that didn't necessarily translate over to overall survival, and reoccurrence in the CNS was a common theme. And however, they're hoping that since the osimertinib has better brain penetration than the first generations, that maybe that might help with that particular area. Additionally, supposedly osimertinib has better apoptotic properties than the first generation. However, overall survival results were immature when the data was published. And actually that caused a lot of questions amongst the oncologists when they first came out with the data at the ASCO meeting, because they were unsure where this trial was actually unblinded, and many people thought it was unblinded at the patient and the clinician level, and that therefore it would hinder our chances to get overall survival data. So it all comes important because osimertinib comes with, of course, side effects. Some of them can be quite dramatic. I'm part of an EGFR mutational lung cancer group. And although not mentioned here, fatigue can be quite detrimental to these patients and limit their quality of life. So if it doesn't help with overall survival, maybe they should wait until they have progression before they initiate therapy. And so one of my questions is, has anybody looked at osimertinib resected patients, because I've noticed in some of the other, when other EGFR TKIs are used, the first generation, and afatinib, which is a second generation, there still seems to be significant disease left despite radiology suggesting that there's less tumor burden. Or if anybody has any comments about this article. I also think that in the future, this may lead to more cases being tested that are not stage four for mutational status.
Pretty dramatic results.
Yeah.
Anybody have any questions, comments for Lacey?
Just that all of our patients get tested regardless of what stage they are. So
yeah, I wanted to ask that question too.
I mean, I'm in Arizona, so I don't know what it is like elsewhere, but.
We are not doing that at Michigan.
Does Arizona have any sort of trials going on there, or is there, clinicians treating the patients despite?
It's possible that that'll be shifting, and I don't know if anybody else is on, but the oncologists, there were two oncologists who, one of whom I think for sure has left, and I don't know about the other one. She wanted it done on all of them, and she wanted the KRAS 600 gene panel just in hopes that they would find something in these patients and that she could potentially even follow. So she's left, so I don't know what I may be wrong about the current status of that, but I know that for years we were doing it on everybody.
I haven't heard that there's intended to be any change in that, although maybe there will. I don't know either.
Well, I think depending on what the overall survival of this trial is, that it might be, headed that way.
Okay, thanks, Lacey. If you can stop sharing, I will try to get mine up.
Right here, top button. Is good?
All right, let's see. If I can find my article. I've had too many windows open. Let's try again.
If we need hand sanitizer, we know where to come.
Here we go. Can you guys see that okay?
Yep.
Okay, good. So this is an article from Christine and Jeff and colleagues at Michigan, and I was excited to read it when I read the title. So diffuse alveolar damage resulting from COVID 2019 infection is morphologically indistinguishable from other causes of DAD. And I thought this was a nice article to answer some of the questions I think I've had, and I'm sure others have had, regarding COVID infection leading to death. And what kind of patterns we're seeing. So as we all know, I think by now, COVID-19 death is associated with a very high prevalence of DAD at autopsy. And there's been some suggestion that there might be some specific morphologic features that are seen in COVID-19 autopsies that aren't necessarily seen in other causes of DAD, but that hasn't really been very clear. And a lot of studies that have looked at this haven't included a control group, which I think is really important, especially when we're talking about things like vascular changes, since we see thrombosis, for example, in DAD all the time. And I think having a controlled group in this setting is really important. So they set out to look at these patients. And basically, they identified, there were a couple goals for their study. One is to compare patients who died in the community of COVID-19 and had an autopsy performed to those who died in the hospital with COVID-19. And then also to compare the COVID-19 patients to a control cohort of patients that died of DAD. So they had four patients that were identified who died in the community with a postmortem diagnosis of COVID-19. And then they matched them with three other cohorts, including four patients who died of COVID-19 after a hospitalization of some duration, four patients who died of DAD in the hospital before the COVID-19 pandemic began, and four patients who died in the community who had autopsy findings of DAD. So they were independently reviewed by three pulmonary pathologists, and two of them were blinded to the cohorts. And they reviewed and scored for histologic features, which are pictured in this this figure here. So basically, these photos were sent around kind of as their baseline or their standardization for what they were looking for in their cases. And that included hyaline membranes, thrombi, airspace organization, kind of resembling organizing pneumonia here, AFOP-like changes with a bunch of intraalveolar fibrin, acute bronchopneumonia. This is perivascular inflammation with some degree of endothelialitis here. And then they also assessed for fibrinoid vascular necrosis and hemorrhage with capillaritis. So their patients had... here's just a comparison of the inpatient COVID-19 cohort and the community cohort that had COVID-19. So underlying conditions were common in all patients with COVID-19, including diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and obesity. The cause of death in the ARDS control group included bacteremia or sepsis due to various causes, a brain hemorrhage in one patient, and chronic bronchiectasis with pneumonia in the fourth patient. So when they were assessing for hyaline membranes, they found that they were present in a unanimous fashion. So all three reviewers found hyaline membrane in 14 of 16 cases. And in 9 cases, there was also unanimous agreement about extent. So basically, they not only evaluated for these histologic features, but they said, are they absent? Are they focal? Are they patchy? Or are they rather diffuse? So fibrinous thrombi were identified in 13 of their 16 cases. And importantly, I think there was no differences in the presence or the extent of the fibrinous thrombi between the COVID positive cases and the control cases. Organizing DAD or organizing pneumonia, airspace organization pattern basically was observed in 3 of 4 cases that were hospitalized, but not in the community COVID patients. So those had a more of a acute or pure DAD type pattern, except for one of their community COVID patients did not seem to have any hyaline membranes, and that patient was also asymptomatic prior to death. So potentially an alternative cause of death who just happened to be COVID positive at the time of autopsy. So as far as these patterns that they were observing, their inter-observer variability was the greatest for the acute fibrinous organizing pneumonia or AFOP-like changes. But there was no difference observed in that particular pattern between the COVID patients and the control patients. They did note that there seemed to be more acute bronchopneumonia in the hospitalized patients than in the COVID community patients, so potentially a complication of prolonged hospitalization or ventilation. And they did not identify any cases that had viral cytopathic effect. They did not identify any capillaritis or hemorrhage, and they did not identify any fibrinoid vascular necrosis. So no cases where there was what we would call, I guess, a true necrotizing vasculitis was not observed. They did note that this perivascular Inflammation was a bit more prominent in the patients with COVID compared to controls, but they did not feel that that was significantly or sufficiently specific to really suggest COVID-19. Their inter-observer variability was a bit high on that. And also it can be seen in the setting of other viral infections, et cetera. So in their discussion, they talk about DAD being very common in autopsy at the time of autopsy in patients with COVID. And therefore, it does seem that lung involvement is a very common cause of death in these patients. There were no real meaningful or unexpected differences identified between the histopathologic patterns that they saw in the hospitalized patients versus those that died in the community of COVID, aside from more organization in the hospitalized group, which is not really surprising given that those patients probably survived a longer time since they were ventilated and aggressively supported. And the this also indicates that DAD observed in the hospitalized patients isn't due to another cause. So it's not due to, you know, ventilation or oxygenation or other things that we do to patients that are in the hospital. The patients that are in the community are also showing changes of DAD. So it's probably directly due to the virus itself. And then furthermore, there were no obvious histological differences. I think this is important between the DAD pattern observed in the COVID patients and those seen in the control group. And specifically, the frequency and extent of the fibrin thrombi was similar between the groups. I think that's about it. Does anybody have questions, comments?
Go ahead, Christine.
Oh, I was just going to say, really nice summary. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for publishing it. I've been dying for somebody to publish whether, because you hear all this stuff about thrombi and other organs and other things. And I've been kind of beating my drum about, well, we see thrombi in DAD all the time. Are you really going to be able to tell any difference at all? I was skeptical that we were. So thank you for publishing this nice study.
Christine, this is Colby. One of the papers that you reference is that paper from Ackerman in the New England Journal that talked about vascular angiogenesis. Is that something you thought about looking at?
I think that they were able to see that at EM. Correct me if I'm wrong, though. So I don't.
Yeah, that was an ultrastructural study.
Yeah, so I don't.
I think there's other studies out there that have shown, increase in reticulin. But at any rate, that was a study that compared COVID-19 and influenza, and they said that COVID-19 had more thrombi, I believe, right?
Yeah, a number of folks have said that, but that wasn't our experience.
Our cohorts were a little small because actually the number that limited our case number in each were the cases of DAD that were non-COVID that died in the community, because I had a hard time looking back. And since that's not something, diffuse alveolar damage that's typically listed as in the diagnostic line of a forensics report, those were really the cases I had a hard time finding. So perhaps if we'd looked at more cases, we would have found that to be true.
This is Andreas. I see that the first sentence in your paper is diffuse alveolar damage is a ubiquitous finding in inpatient coronavirus disease. I'm just wondering whether you had any other types of death during that period from COVID.
I think at this time, no. I mean, Jeff, do you recall? I don't.
At the time we did that paper, and I don't know that it's changed because I haven't kept up with all of our autopsies, but at that time, every autopsied adult with COVID had DAD.
There's a paper from Columbia that I think about 10% don't have DAD, and the assumption is they have cardiac arrest.
And that doesn't surprise me with the one patient the decedent who was the prisoner in whom we did not find DAD, but was COVID positive in our forensics cohort, he had a cardiac event.
So it seems that clinically, though, thrombotic thrombotic disease seems to be a problem. And so I'm wondering how you reconcile that. You think that you don't see more thrombotic disease because they actually treat?
I think the evidence that they have macroscopic thrombotic disease as a life-ending event is pretty clear. And in a subsequent different publication, I think one of our forensics patients fit that profile, but did not have DAD. So in this case, we were focused on the small fibrin thrombi and DAD. And at that point, we didn't have a patient who had died of macroscopic thromboses, but we've seen that since. And I think the literature on that is pretty solid that probably is a COVID thing. It just wasn't a thing in this cohort.
And probably they actually treat patients against thrombotic complications, you think? So that may have an effect on the disease as you see it at autopsy.
I think there are preventive strategies in any patient in the ICU for the same thing, and whether they're different protocols for COVID patients, I don't really know.
From our calls with that I've been on with our pulmonary medicine intensivists, they're doing the exact same thing that they do for any of their other ARDS patients. As far as
as an aside, I've seen about 25 biopsies on COVID patients from patients in Italy that I'm not quite sure I want to know why they were biopsied, but just as an aside, I didn't see thrombi in any of those biopsies. Some of them are cryobiopsies, a couple are open biopsies, and a couple are transbronchials.
All righty. Great discussion, everybody. So in the last 4 minutes, I'm just going to try to really briefly touch on this article, which I think might be important for all of us to know about. So this is a proposal for a grading system for invasive pulmonary adenocarcinoma from the IASLC pathology committee. So as we all know, you know, pulmonary adenocarcinoma is very diverse. It shows lots of different growth patterns, and we can learn some important things, I think, about the behavior of the tumor if we pay attention to what growth patterns that we're seeing. However, the current WHO kind of has done the predominant pattern reporting is what is recommended for us to do now. That has a lot of different groups and can lead to inter-observer variability. And it would be nice if we had a more streamlined system for grading. I think that would be nice if they were formally translated into a tumor grade that we could apply. And that's basically what they're going for in this study. So basically they're saying that based on predominant pattern, you can kind of elucidate a grading system with grade 1 being lipidic predominant, grade 2 being papillary and acinar predominant, and grade 3 being solid and micropapillary predominant. However, we all know that there's some gray zones specifically, or some gaps, specifically the cribriform predominant or complex glandular fused glands pattern is not well addressed. So there are many people that probably include that as an acinar pattern or an intermediate grade pattern when there's pretty clear cut data that that's an aggressive, a high grade pattern. Some people may interpret it as solid and go that route. So there's, too much ambiguity regarding that pattern in the current system. So basically what they did here is a multi-institutional study. They had a training set that they had from New York. A validation set was used from, I think, Brigham. And then a testing set where they had 300 patients, which is another group from Boston and some from Australia. So basically, they had all of these with comprehensive histologic subtyping performed. Here's just, I think, some pictures of what they mean by complex glandular patterns that should be included probably with our high-grade patterns, solid and micropapillary. And they basically looked at various I'm just going to move you guys so I can see. There we go. So various iterations of a grading scheme. So their baseline was just clinical data. And that they then from there, they added just predominant pattern. And then they started adding all sorts of different iterations. So predominant pattern plus the second most predominant pattern plus any degree of high grade pattern, predominant pattern with at least 20% high grade pattern, and then all sorts of other very complex grading schemes. And basically what they found was what worked pretty well was the predominant pattern plus any degree of high grade pattern that represented more than 20% of the tumor. They felt like that was relatively practical and reproducible. So what they proposed based on this study, and again, I'm not going to go into too much detail here, is a grading scheme. If I can find my table here, here it is. Oop. There we go. Crying out loud. Their grading scheme that they propose basically is anything with greater than 20% of high grade pattern is considered grade three. Anything that is acinar or papillary predominant with less than 20% of high grade pattern is grade two. And anything that has lipidic predominance with less than 20% high grade pattern is grade one. So they looked at basically the performance of this versus just the predominant pattern based grading system, and found that they had better separation specifically between grades two and three when they do this this scheme as opposed to just using predominant pattern, where our grades two and three get pretty muddled up. So that is what they're proposing based on this study. Any comments or questions on that? I realize it's 9 o'clock, so we're at the top of the hour.
Jen, this is Henry. I presume they didn't include mucinous at all?
They did not include mucinous at all.
So again,
that's right.
They're sort of leaving out this whole group of tumors where we're all having sort of trouble figuring out the best way to grade them, colloid included. And
They excluded AIS. They excluded minimally invasive adenocarcinoma. They excluded mucinous, invasive mucinous adenocarcinoma, and anybody with multifocal adenocarcinoma was excluded as well. So these are just solitary invasive pulmonary adenocarcinomas included in this study with no mucinous tumors.
That was a really great journal club. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, everybody, for the great discussion.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Have
a great Monday.
Everyone.